Good morning, Your Honors. Sam Levin on behalf of Ronald Everett. Your Honors, one of the most fundamental rules that we follow in family law is the notion that the court's power to modify the support of a minor child cannot be taken away by contract. It's a rule that was really laid out in the Supreme Court's case of Kelly, in this court's case of Shoup, but it's also not a modern rule, at least as far back as 1930. Even in Gloth v. Gloth, which is 154 VA 511, the Supreme Court recognized the idea that a contract cannot, as they called it, render the court's power to modify child support nugatory, useless, or of no importance. But in this case, the appellee seeks, and the trial court allowed, an end run. It allowed a set of wordings that a party can use in an agreement to do, in effect, what they cannot do in principle. The trial court has basically said that in this case, if child support is tied to another number, a number that is itself not modifiable, then the court meets its obligations under Shoup and Kelly by simply saying, okay, the court has jurisdiction over child support, maybe even saying, here's what child support should be, but that means the number it's tied to adjusts to compensate so the total support number remains unchanged. So, in other words, we have a situation where the appellee argues and the trial court agreed that there is a way to make child support unmodifiable by contract. That way is to tie it to another number, which itself, if standing alone, would be unmodifiable when made by contract. I would suggest that that runs into the same problem that the court tried to address in Kelly and Shoup and even way back in Gloth, the idea that the court is ultimately the arbiter of child support because there's a recognition fundamentally that the parents may not always act in the best interests of the child. So by saying that you can render essentially the jurisdiction of the trial court useless by tying the support number to another number, in this case, it was the support for an adult child. In another case, it could be spousal support. It could be a set property division. Whatever it is, saying that you can tie those numbers together.
Mr. Baldwin, can I ask you about Kelly, the Supreme Court's decision in Kelly? Because
yes. I don't mean to correct, Your Honor. I'm Mr. Levin, but you can go ahead.
I'm sorry, Mr.
That's fine.
Thank you. I'm Mr. Levin. A divorce, in Kelly, the court did say a divorce court retains continuing jurisdiction to change or modify its decree relating to the maintenance and support of minor children. Consequently, parents cannot contract away their children's rights to support. It seems to be the big point of Kelly. Nor can the court be exercise the power to decree child support. That second sentence that begins with consequently doesn't talk about modifying. It just talks about contracting away or precluded by agreement from exercising its power to decree child support. It doesn't say decree or modify. The sentence before it does use the verb modify. I assume this is the language you're talking about.
Yes, that is the language. Precisely the language I'm talking about. And I do think that those two sentences have to be read together. The court decrees child support every time it modifies it. And as a child grows, their needs change, the court has to be able to come back and decree child support again. That is ultimately what a modification is. So I would suggest that, you know, the reason the court used the word modify to begin with is that the two terms interplay directly. The court is being deprived, from decreeing child support in the future by this kind of an agreement.
Can I ask you then about the Shoup case?
Mm-hmm.
In Shoup, the Court of Appeals en banc found essentially that it was so clear in the agreement. You had the three children, husband, when one reached the cutoff period of 18 or graduated from high school, said, okay, I'm cutting the child support by one-third, and the wife didn't say anything at that point. But when the second child, he cut it by another one-third, when that second child reached it, then she filed suit. And the Court of Appeals en banc said, that's fine, and why go to court and use the court's time and all this attorney's fees and so forth to do so. But wasn't the agreement a little bit clearer that that could was self-executing, if you will, or could be self-executing in Shoup than it is here? Or help me understand how this agreement is like the one in Shoup, as I guess my question.
Sure. And I think to some degree here actually might be shoehorning into our fourth assignment of error, I think, which is that we argued that the agreement allowed the whole thing to be modifiable, which is, you know, not so much my focus on oral argument. But we do think that the agreement itself is fundamentally clear that modification is contemplated, and it allows it sets out the consequences which, by the way, the appellee has taken advantage of. That is her right under the agreement, but clearly it lays out that modification is contemplated within the agreement. Now, in terms of dividing between the children, which might be the other point that Your Honor is getting to, we would agree that the agreement is not clear on that, and to that extent, there are two paths that I think the court can take, because saying that it's indivisible, cannot be divided, while also saying that it cannot be changed, is, in our opinion, directly contrary to what the court has said in Kelly and Shoup, and again, as far back as Gloth in the Supreme Court in 1930. If you're going to say that it's indivisible, you've basically rendered the court's jurisdiction over the modification of a minor child support useless. So it has to be divisible in order for a court to have a meaningful exercise of jurisdiction over the minor child support. Now, we would suggest again that there are two approaches the court could take to that. One would be to say, well, the default rule is that it divides evenly, but we can take evidence that there is a different intent, and since it's not clear in the contract, that would have to be parole evidence. Or you could just start from the beginning and say, well, let's take parole evidence on this since it's unambiguous.
Because, as you know, as an appellate court, we can't be fact finders. So you would then ask us to remand it for the trial court to make
that is our request, is that the ruling on the motion in limine, which said that we can't present any evidence on divisibility, as part that be reversed and this case be remanded for further proceedings. The case didn't get to a point where the appellate court could make factual findings. There's not enough in the record there. We don't have the incomes of the parties or anything like that, because the case was essentially cut off at its knees by the motion in limine ruling. So yes, it is our request that the motion in limine be reversed and this case remanded for further proceedings consistent with the opinion of the appellate court. So we don't dispute fundamentally that Mr. Everett did agree to support his children into their majority. And we understand that the Cutshaw opinion from the Supreme Court says that can't be changed. We believe Cutshaw was wrongly decided, but we understand that this court's not really in a position to say to the Supreme Court, well, you got it wrong, so we're going to ignore you. But we do also, that's the main reason I'm not spending too much time on that point. But
that would be a wise choice.
But there is also the point that there's this incongruity in the trial court's ruling that fundamentally is saying, well, if I set the minor child support at one number, then the adult child support must be the difference between that number and $5,000, so you get the $5,000 a month. That was the trial court's rationale for its decision that it couldn't change, is that the agreement meant that the adult child support is always the difference between the minor child support and the $5,000 a month. That is, in fact, especially over time, if you have multiple hearings, changing the adult child's support, which is also contrary to the Cutshaw opinion. So it's kind of this internal inconsistency that arises in this situation. And just at the end of the day, we're faced with a situation where, admittedly temporarily, we have an agreement that cannot jive with Cutshaw, with Kelly, and with Shoup, that says, right now, according to the trial court, right now, support's just not modifiable. It doesn't matter that you have a minor child. Support is what it is, and that's it. And the implications of this ruling are a little bit startling, because in this situation, it might sound like it's two fairly well-off individuals arguing over a reasonably large amount of money, but we could have a situation easily where a practitioner gets wind of this case, says, wait, I can use this. I can say that whenever a parent receives child support, the other parent will receive untaxed spousal support of the same amount, and suddenly they've waived child support forever. That's exactly what this kind of an agreement could say, because again, spousal support is a number that when it's set by contract can't be modified by the court. So at the end of the day, we're faced with a situation where the court is making an end run around the appellate precedents that say that that the court must have jurisdiction to modify the minor child support. We don't think that that's proper under the precedents.
Why do we need to get there if we can construe the agreement according to its language, which contemplates modification?
Well, that would also work for us. If the court agrees with us in our fourth assignment.
Now, it comes with consequences, as you pointed out.
Right.
A wife can be entitled to pursue her marital share of husband's business interests, etc., and then he's responsible for attorney's fees.
Right. And to be clear, Your Honor, I'm not waiving any of the arguments we've made on brief. I fully agree. And in fact, this is not the first time. I don't know if Your Honor's had the time to delve into the long and sordid history of this case. This is the third time it's been up to the Court of Appeals on some matter.
We're happy to have job security.
Well, thank you, Your Honors. But that's already happened, in fact. All of those consequences have been borne because
the husband's already paid her $75,000 for marital share of the business or something.
That we had a trial over that. That was ordered. The attorney's fees have come up. The attorney's fees was actually the source of the last time.
You're starting to get into your three-minute rebuttal time, just so you know.
Okay. So fundamentally, we just do believe that when it comes down to it, either this court should find that the whole amount is modifiable, which we would suggest that the language in the agreement just does suggest, or that the amount must be divisible so that the minor child support can be properly modified by the trial court. And I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thanks. All right.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, David Masterman, appearing for Asla Crome, formerly Asla Everett, who I will probably refer to as Asla Everett during argument. A great misconception that needs to be cleared up immediately is the notion that the lower court determined that child support for Celine was non-modifiable. It never did that. But the trial court below, both Judge Clark and later Judge Kemmler, it being Judge Kemmler's order that's on appeal, determined was that whatever amount was set for Celine plus Ronnie, who was the child in college over the age of 18, had to equal at least $5,000. Now, why do I say at least? Because when modifying Celine's support, it's entirely possible that her support by itself could have exceeded $5,000. And had that happened, the number would have been higher. But if it's lower, let's arbitrarily say it's $3,500. If it's $3,500, we don't have to have an income and expense statement or a listing of expenses or any other document to determine what the amount remaining due for Ronnie, the older child, is. We know what that amount is because it's going to be a mathematical formula, and formulas are permitted when setting up support for an adult. The formula is going to be 5,000 minus X equals how much that child gets.
But doesn't the assumption of that argument, based on what you argued below, indicate that if Celine's is modifiable downward, then Ronald's automatically goes up? And wouldn't even that violate Cutshaw?
No. I'll tell you why not. Because you're not modifying the child support amount. I'm sorry, method of calculation, you're modifying the amount. So, for example, the party said the child support for the adult child, Ronnie, will always be 10% of the husband's income. Let's just say that. He's above the age of 18, so that would have been valid. Yes, the number would have changed, but it still would have been valid. Here they said it's going to be a number that allows it to add up for 5,000. Now, we have basically three compartments here, and this may be helpful and informative on that point.
Can I follow up on that?
Of course you may.
Because it's hard to understand in looking at the agreement, since Ronald is now in college, and there's another portion of the agreement that says husband and wife share half and half all of his college expenses, including room and board, which would include food and so forth, that he would have, of course, been part of the child support, presumably, when he was younger than 18 and in high school. So why, given we have that aspect, why is it possible then that his portion of this could rise if hers is decreased? It would again seem to defeat the purpose of the agreement, as well as, I guess, if you can't mess with his at all, if it's not modifiable under Cutshaw, it just, I still am not quite following why it hasn't been modified at that point, which would also further seem to defeat the purpose of the agreement.
I'm going to answer it in three different ways. The first way is to go back to the argument I've already presented orally here, which is the suggestion that his calculation is a mathematical problem more than it's a fixed number. That's the first thing. The second point is that you're in an interesting phase here. There's phase one when both are minors, and there's going to be a phase three when both are over the age of majority. But you're now when one is straddling the fence. One is over 18, one is under 18. What is the amount of support there? They didn't choose to say, for example, it's $2,500 per child. They would have been free to say that. They didn't say that. And incidentally, to a point made earlier in the oral argument, you can't presume that it would be 50-50 each. If you look at the child support guidelines under 2108.2, the support for one child is more typically about 60-65% of the support for two children. So that doesn't
stand. The agreement says that a child court could not apportion it. What prevents that?
Well, the trial court apportioning it would be an idle act. But more to the point, for the child support to be calculated, I mean, it could be apportioned in this sense. I want to be careful using the word apportionment, but I think we're both on the same page here. You could say that Celine's child support is $3,500. Necessarily, that means that the mathematical formula to determine Ronnie's support is going to yield a number which happens to be $1,500. Or if it's 4,000, it's 1,000, et cetera. We could do examples all day long. So you could say that, and if that's what you mean by apportionment, yes. But if what you mean by apportionment is we're going to sit down and we're going to look at each and every one of Ronnie's expenses, we're going to see how much he pays over and above the college tuition for transportation, what he pays to have a new wardrobe, what he pays to have a computer, all those sorts of things that can come up, that's not an inquiry that is permitted. It's also not one that occurred below, so we'd be speculating to get into what that number would be in any event. But that can't be the way you do it. The way the law... Yes, under Cutshaw, under other cases as well, but Cutshaw is certainly the easiest.
If we're remanded, though, if we were to decide to remand it, what in the agreement, though, prevents an apportionment by the trial court, just apportioning it, and not necessarily going through all of that factual analysis?
Just to say it's 50-50 each, or some other percentage each?
Some other number.
Okay. The reason it's, well, first of all, it's an idle act, because we already know what the ultimate number is going to be. And second, you're apportioning it only in reverse. What you're doing, and you could do this, you could figure out what the expenses are for Celine or what the presumed child support guideline amount is for Celine. And that's why I said earlier, if that's what you mean by apportionment, the answer is yes, you could remand, they could do that. Here's why you shouldn't do it. Because if you do that, we already know that the outcome in the amount of support for both children is going to be $5,000. Now let's deal with some horrible possible facts here. Hate to say it out loud, but Ronnie dies. If that happens, then the amount of support that you're going to be looking at is going to be the presumptive child support amount. If it's $3,500, is the number I've thrown out a couple times here just as an example, that's what it's going to be. It doesn't automatically...
It would stay $5,000 in that.
Well, no, it would be $3,500 until Celine reached the age of 18, and then it would be $5,000.
So basically... Your argument is that it stays $5,000 not only until Ronnie graduates from college, because by the time he does, she will have reached 18 and she'll be in college too. It will have to stay $5,000 until she graduates from college.
With the caveat that I haven't actually sat down and done the timeline to see if there is maybe a small window, but I think when you look at their ages, what you just said is reasonable to assume.
Well, if that's the case, if there's really nothing that can be done until she turns 22 or 23 or whenever she graduates from college. Here you have just two children. What if you had 10 children from ages 1 up to 20?
Okay.
Which certainly happens. And only one is in college. But as before that one finishes, you follow my logic here, another one's in college, and then another one. But you have language that says like this, probably be more than $5,000 a month, but let's say it's $20,000 a month. What would allow the court to change that until that one-year-old graduated from college? Why wouldn't it stay $20,000 if we take your argument to its logical conclusion?
Assuming I followed your argument, it might. This would be a decision made by the parents as to what support is necessary for their adult children that led to that conclusion, though. And I think that may be the difference. I think Your Honor is concerned about how do I can't take away the power of the lower court to modify child support for a minor. I'm agreeing with that. Both judges below agree with that.
But the effect of the ruling takes it away, essentially. And that's the point of my question with regard to the 10 children as opposed to two. If one is past 18, is no longer a minor, and is in college, and the agreement says the same thing as this one does, essentially. Why would the logical conclusion of your argument is that it just can't be modified from that $20,000 a month for the 10 children until the last child has graduated from college?
We may end up agreeing. The support for each minor child, whether it's 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, etc., can always be modified. The total amount paid so that the contractual amount for the child over the age of majority is paid to the correct amount is going to make the total come out, in your example, to $20,000.
It would stay 20.
It could potentially go higher.
Well, why doesn't that violate Kelly and Shoup?
It doesn't violate Kelly or Shoup for this reason. Shoup set up a clear mechanism whereby as children reach the age of majority, there could be an adjustment. It cites paragraphs 5, D, and E of that agreement that explains how it's going to happen in the opinion itself. And that doesn't deal with post-majority support. That deals with what we do to lower the support so that parties, as I believe Your Honor said, don't have to come back to court each time that there's an adjustment. In Kelly, that's the case that we attorneys tend to shorthand as being the case that says don't give away the house to try to get out child support, because we tried to give away the house to get out child support. You still have the authority in the court to make sure that the minor child receives support, and that is still true here. Celine is always going to be, until she's 18, able to get support from the court, even in an amount greater than $5,000. Should that be what the numbers indicate? We don't know. There's no proffer of what.
Lesser than $5,000.
It could also be an amount lesser than $5,000. Of course it could be.
But not for.
But that's exactly right. The combination of the two.
Or for her when she's turned 18.
Or when she turns 18, because then we've taken it out of the area, the time, that the lower court can modify it and put it into a different time. Now, there's another important point that I raise in the brief, and I want to raise this right now. And that is, let's think about how we ended up before this court. We had the two judges below who ruled, you may go ahead with your hearing. You can have your hearing, and you can put on your evidence, and you can see what the effect of this is going to be. But at the end of the day, it's going to add up to $5,000. So don't come at it from the standpoint of telling us what Ronnie's expenses are. That's what the court said. And you've got an order that shows that that's what the ruling was. Now, what happens is, having heard that there was a setback, in the same way that somebody in a personal injury case might hear that they can't use their expert, Mr. Everett elected voluntarily to dismiss his action. So I don't think that this panel actually reaches the underlying issues, because I think that what you have here is you have a voluntarily dismissed case before you. You had an evidentiary ruling that he didn't like.
Wasn't that sort of, it was understood that at that point he couldn't prevail, and the order even says that the court encouraged him not to go.
Well, the transcript says that, so the order says that as well. It said, think about your position. And then the next paragraph, which is paragraph 2 of the order, Your Honor is obviously familiar with it, says, having done that, the parties agree that he dismisses his case. Now, he had a lot of other options at that point. He could have, had he wanted to, taken an interlocutory appeal. He could have, had he wanted to, do the motion equivalent of a non-suit, withdrawn his motion and started over. He could have, if he wanted to, put on his case either by proffer or by actually putting on his case, and maybe there would have been a new number named for Celine, and then he could have been before Your Honor making the argument, well, this is the number for Celine. It's inappropriate that the number stayed the same for Ronnie. He did none of those things.
Yeah, but then he's still stuck with it at the same exact same level that he's trying to modify, so I'm not sure I see the point of proceeding to a doomed hearing and expending the party's time and resources when it's really not going to affect the outcome that matters, which is the number at the end of the day.
It would be disingenuous for me to say that I wanted to go through a doomed hearing, as Your Honor called it, so I'm not upset that he didn't go through a doomed hearing. However, the value of that
hearing... A victory lap for you, but...
I'll go take another one somewhere else. Yeah. But the more important point there is that that's why some of the questions that this panel is asking me are coming up, because we don't know what the trial court would have done as far as apportioning and deciding how much Celine's was going to be, if you want to call that apportioning, as we said earlier, because the court was never asked to do that. They never went forward with that. So there's some speculation that's being required, and with all due respect, that speculation is not Ms. Everett's fault. The speculation is coming about because there is no proffer from below, and there is no ruling from below as to that substantive issue. So Mr. Everett, having heard that when he is at the end of the day, his support is going to be some number for Celine plus some number for Ronnie calculated by a formula that's going to end up being $5,000, elected not to go forward. And I say that, there's another assumption here, of course, which is we're assuming it would have been a number lower than $5,000. There's facts outside the record because there's no proffer that we'd have to speculate about in order to determine whether it might have gone up. But let's not even do that. So that's the situation we find ourselves in. And I think that the problem here is that you get to the point where we're talking about Mr. Everett having been denied any rights, we have to start with a false premise. And the false premise is that he was told he couldn't modify the support for Celine. He was told the reverse. He was told the support for his older child, Ronnie, cannot be modified. And then he said, okay, well, what's the support amount for my older child? And it's going to be a number calculated by Celine's support subtracted from $5,000, if expressed in that way, basically. Because of that, going forward with the hearing, it would have been a doomed hearing, as Your Honor said, but it would have been a doomed hearing not because it was unfair to him, it would be because that would be upholding the agreement. Virginia's a strong contract state. Tiffany versus Tiffany is one of the earliest cases to say so. The court would have been asked to do nothing more than to say, you've contracted to support your adult child, you're going to have to do that. If there are no other questions, I can conclude my argument at this time.
Thank you for your argument.
You.
We have a 3-minute rebuttal.
With your orders.
Mr. Levin, what do you say to Mr. Masterman's point that he just made about, well, it could have been proffered, some of this information could have been proffered?
Well, we were discovery was essentially discontinued at this point because we were so limited in what we could present. So we weren't really at a position where we could proffer. There wasn't ever an evidentiary hearing held. And to be clear, this wasn't just some passing remark from the trial judge about how you should consider your position. We have, you know, on page 173 of our appendix, Mr. Masterman openly admitted in the court that even without a dismissal included in their order, a ruling in their favor makes us unable to win. Then on page 203 of the appendix in lines 1 to 7, the trial judge says there's no need for a hearing because the end result is going to be $5,000 per month no matter what. The judge goes on to say, the court is going to grant the motion in limine, recognizing that the result is that the motion to modify is dismissed. And then when saying that she won't actually dismiss the motion, she tells appellant's counsel, you need to go and consider your position in light of these rulings. Are you really going, you know, are you really going to waste your client's time and money, the court's time, to hear a hearing where you can't have a result? Paragraph 1C of the written order says the court foresees no proper evidence available to the defendant that would permit him to prove that the amount of child support for the minor child and the child over the age of majority shall be less than $5,000. So we have very clearly laid out from the trial judge, you can't win. You can't get the relief your motion seeks And we're now in a position where we have a client who, you know, despite what the numbers may imply, does not have unlimited resources. We have ethical obligations under the rules of professional conduct about going forward with what would essentially be a frivolous hearing. There are potentially consequences under rule, under
you
section.
You objected all along the way to the hearings that led up to that point. So I don't, I
we
just,
did. Anyway. And the dismissal order contained all of our objections. We carried our objections through. If there is any rule to come out of that from that sense, it would be that where you've been rendered impossible to prevail, it doesn't defeat your right to appeal if you allow the case to be dismissed, so long as you carry your objections through, which we did. Our objections appear on the final order issued by the trial court. I did also want to address counsel's point that the support for Sellin can be changed. It is still fundamentally taking away the court's power to, that gets to our fundamental argument here. It is still fundamentally taking away the court's power to modify the support for a minor child when saying, no matter what you set, the trial, now he says it could be more, but Even if we take that for its word, if it's less, then no matter what you set it for, the total support's going to be $5,000, then what is the meaning of the trial court's jurisdiction? We would argue that, again, using the Gloth case's word, the trial court's power has thus been rendered nugatory. So,
The court's power, I suppose, the answer would be, is to enforce the contract that they freely entered into, and if that's a bad contract, then come up with better contracts next time.
Oh, I understand that point, Your Honor. But again, the court says that the parties can't contract this away, and so that's fundamentally what we're dealing with. I would also point out that this formula of $5,000 per month minus whatever Sellin support is appears nowhere in the contract. So again, that's just something that's getting read into the contract.
Can I ask you what I ask Mr. Sure. Masterman? Where in the contract does it prohibit the trial court from apportioning a portion to each child?
Absolutely nowhere. I don't see anywhere in the contract that says that the trial court cannot do that. Okay. So with that being the case, Your Honors, we would ask that the orders of the trial court be reversed and that this case be remanded for further proceedings.
Thank you for your arguments. We'll greet counsel and take up the final case of the day.